call the meeting to order. This is a joint meeting of the Special Committee on Alaska's Royalty Oil in conjunction with the Senate Resources Committee chaired by Senator Kate Poland and with the Senate Finance Committee chaired by Senator John Sackett, who is absent because of work on the budget. It's our intent at this joint hearing to hear from the principals involved in the Alpetco contract and also from the Special Committee's consultant. For the record, time permitting, we will hear a presentation from a member of OLMAR. But in the event that time does not permit, I'd like to, for the record, introduce a written statement that has been presented to me. Our first participant today will be the Senate Special Consultant, Mr. Earl Johnson of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Earl, would you please take table?
Senators, I asked for an early hearing today on this matter because I have some amended remarks to make. I've done a considerable amount of homework since the last testimony that I gave on May the 11th, and I will then forthwith read a prepared statement that I have made amending some of my opinions as expressed in that May 11th statement.
Mr. Johnson, if you would allow, please, a slight interruption. For those members who are not members of the Special Committee, you do have in front of you Mr. Johnson's presentation of Thursday past to the committee if you wish to refer to it. Thank you.
Senators, since testifying before this committee on May 11th, I've received and noted several items of additional information that I consider pertinent and highly significant. Enough so, in fact, to appreciably alter some of my attitudes toward the Alpetco contract as it pertains to royalty oil purchases. These changes also must affect my testimony, and I should like to make the following brief statement prior to further consideration of the Alpetco matter. Following my testimony on May 11, I discussed the Alpetco contract with Commissioner Laresh and Deputy Commissioner Bonnes, especially with regard to my testimony which opposed the early taking of royalty oil. I had characterized such early taking of crude by Alpetco as a probable indirect subsidy to the project by the state due to my visualizing an opportunity for Alpetco to purchase crude under the contract's pricing formula at a price which would permit them to discount North Slope royalty oil on the West Coast and still make a profit. I found my discussion with Mr. Laresh and Mr. Bonnes very enlightening. Both of these gentlemen are exceptionally well informed, both with respect to the subtleties of the Alpetco contract and with respect to the crude oil marketplace generally. In arriving at some of the conclusions outlined in my earlier testimony, I had used a weighted average price, FOB Valdez, of $11.45, based on the marketing of two-thirds royalty oil on the West Coast and Valdez and one-third on the Gulf Coast. These figures are essentially correct, but do not fully address the unique pricing mechanism in the proposed contract. This pricing mechanism contains a feature that substitutes the average point of delivery price of all of the other producers for the actual price of any producer whose actual point of delivery price is lower than the weighted average of all the other producers' prices. This feature tends to protect the state from receiving a low price from Alpetco under any circumstance, but especially under those actual crude marketing practices now existing with respect to North Slope crude. Specifically, some 61% of the North Slope crude was marketed at Valdez and on the West Coast during March 1978, with the other 39% going to the Gulf Coast. The calculated weighted average price at TAPS Inlet was $5.16 per barrel, which was $11.43 FOB Valdez, a very close correlation with the figure that I had used in my earlier calculations, by the way. However, The pricing in the contract would set the Alpetco purchase price under the contract at $6.09 a TAPS inlet, or $12.36 FOB Valdez. Since this would result in a delivered West Coast cost to Alpetco of approximately $13.25, there would obviously be no incentive for Alpetco to exercise its crude option, and certainly no way to discount in the West Coast market, since the going rate for North Slope crude is approximately $13 per barrel at present on the West Coast. This pricing anomaly results essentially from the fact that almost all of the crude going to the Gulf Coast is Sohio's. Their crude is thus priced at a weighted average $4.34 at TAPS inlet. Since the weighted average price of all other producers excluding Sohio is $6.09, this price is substituted in the pricing formula as the price per barrel for Sohio's crude in weight averaging all of the crudes. The foregoing prices are based on actual volumes and prices as reported to the state for March 1978. I've calculated additional simulated conditions for March and have concluded that even if Sohio commenced marketing an additional 100,000 barrels per day on the West Coast instead of on the Gulf Coast, and Exxon and ARCO each sold 50,000 more barrels per day on the Gulf Coast instead of the West Coast, the Alpetco price at TAPS inlet would still be $5.53, which equates to $12.70 on the West Coast. Even this very substantial change in West Coast market balance between companies, which I do not regard as likely in the near future, would not produce a contract price low enough to permit Alpetco to discount significantly in the West Coast market and still achieve a profit on the sale of crude. Because of this special pricing feature, the full import of which I had not realized at the time of my earlier testimony, I now believe there is very little likelihood of Alpetco's early taking of crude, and even less likelihood that if such early taking does occur after 25 months, that the state would be adversely affected as to price. In the light of my more complete information, I visualize the Alpetco's possible sales of crude on the West Coast would have no serious effect in the West Coast marketplace. I retract my earlier statement regarding the crude option to Alpetco constituting an indirect subsidy by the state to the Alpetco project, since I have been convinced that the state is reasonably protected by the pricing clause. The foregoing represents a substantial alteration in my testimony since last week. Briefly stated, I now feel much more comfortable about the crude dedication features of the Alpetco contract. As earlier stated, I have been very favorably impressed with the grasp that your Royalty Commissioner and his staff have of the contract and its implications. Certainly, from the standpoint of the present administration attitude, one can feel assured that the benchmark requirements would indeed be rigidly and narrowly interpreted. Thank you for the opportunity to amend my earlier testimony. My change of attitude about part of the contract is based on several hours of calculation based on actual March 1978 movements of crude as reported and an application of the Alpetco purchase price clause to these actual crude deliveries and modifications thereof. Thank you, sir.
Yes. Any questions, Mr. Johnson? John, please.
Mr. Johnson, you were troubled by the lack of precise definition of the word commitment.
Yes, sir.
Those words still bother you?
They still bother me, but I've searched my soul to decide if there's a better way to do it, and I have found no better way. I don't know how I would suggest that be improved. I'm also persuaded, Senator, that the word commit perhaps means more in the financial community and in the financial sense that it does than it means to me as a non-legal and non-financial person, as it were.
Some of your change of viewpoint seems based on the existing administration, the existing commissioner, and their understanding.
Not at all, sir. It's based on a further understanding of the pricing mechanism. My preparation time for my earlier testimony was not as long as I would have liked for it to be, nor did I have quite as much information at my disposal as I have had since that time. I was able to work on the amended impression based on actual deliveries of crude, actual movements of crude, and actual net back prices at TAPS inlet. I did not have that information before.
You say in your statement today, that from the standpoint of the President's administration attitude, one can feel assured that the benchmark requirements benchmark requirements would indeed be rightly and narrowly interpreted.
No, rigidly and narrowly interpreted.
Sorry, rigidly and narrowly interpreted. And I assume that that is a part of the thing that makes you feel better about the contract.
Yes, I think so. And that's a feeling. I can't be precise about it, but certainly I do feel more comfortable than at long range I could have felt.
My question then is, a future administration, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, whatever, may have a different viewpoint.
There is no question in my mind but that a future administration might either more rigidly or more loosely interpret the contract. Yes, sir. I'm sure that's true.
It doesn't sound from your wording here that they could be more narrowly interpreted. They are, in fact, narrow now.
I would hope they would be, Senator.
If, in fact, this is more loosely interpreted by the future administration.
That calls for a little more crystal ball gazing than I think I should participate in. I think it's obvious to all of us that a great deal of interpretation is involved in paragraph 10.2.
You don't feel there's any way around that interpretation, that contractually that interpretation may be reduced?
I haven't seen a way, Senator. I'm puzzled over that, and I think this was a really difficult part of drafting the contract as it now exists, and it appears to me that a strong effort was made to pin it down as tightly as it can be pinned down.
Is there anything then about this contract that troubles you as distinct consultant?
There are many things, none of which would rock the earth, Senator. I've made some comments in the latter part of my report last time, my testimony last time, that I said were technical considerations, and I think are not earth-shattering one way or the other. Relatively minor considerations, and probably not anything that could be materially changed at this late date. In any event, probably wouldn't even be worth it.
Thank you. You're through, Senator. Any other questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question. I have a comment that some of this research, I will clarify, for the meeting was done at my request. And I appreciate you candidly addressing that and coming back in the face of it, countering some of your earlier testimony, and without trying to massage it, coming straight out and saying that you amend your testimony. I think that's commendable.
Thank you.
Senator Huber.
Yes, I want to proceed just a little further, maybe with one question. Would your original judgment be correct if a future administration interpreted the contract as loosely as you believe it might be possible under the terms of the contract?
Yes, sir. We're talking about a matter of degree, but of course, as I say, there is room for a considerable variation in rigidity and looseness in the interpretation of the contract, and I would presume that would currently relate to the attitude of a subsequent administration.
I think that's exactly what Senator Orsini was getting at, what I was interested in.
Yeah.
I think it's a very clear answer that if they interpreted it as loosely as it could be under the contract, that it would put your original judgment back in instead of your modified testimony.
Senator, I want to be very careful, though, to underscore the fact that I consider that I am a qualified consultant in the area of the marketing of crude oil, not in the area of the construction and the profitability of petrochemical facilities. And paragraph 10.2, except in one principal respect, I was mostly bothered at the outset by the crude oil ramifications, by the early taking provision, which could be triggered by a loose interpretation of paragraph 10.23d, to be very specific. And I have to say that since I find myself less concerned about the whole matter of early crude oil taking prior to operation of the plant, then I have to be much less troubled from a crude oil standpoint about the about the language of paragraph 10.2. How it goes, how it plays as far as the state's concerned, aside from the area of my specialty, I don't want to be the interpreter of that. Do you follow what I'm saying? That I, rigidly or loosely, I'm not really all that troubled about the crude oil portion of this thing as it stands right now. And that's the reason I didn't say a great deal more than I did about the word commit.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Senator.
The next participants are Commissioner Laresh. Commissioner, do you wish the Deputy Commissioner to accompany you?
I wouldn't go any place without it.
Fine, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we'll keep our remarks brief today in light of the fact that we have met with the special committee at least once before in the opening hearings along with the House side. And what I'd like to do is just run down once more the philosophy and technique behind our negotiations on behalf of the state with Alpetco and the other firms that we dealt with. Then run over briefly, very briefly, two or three of the questions that have been raised continually in House consideration of this contract. Now, as you're all aware, last year a change in the royalty statute essentially required that the state take royalty in kind unless the commissioner could make a finding that a taking in value was more in the state's interest. And it required that we take in kind under a royalty oil and gas statute that is strongly slanted toward in-state use, which leverages the things we want over and above the price received for the crude oil. That is, a royalty statute strongly suggests that the state should use its royalty crude to help create jobs, to lever the refining of products in the state, and to lever associated development. In other words, the statute defines why we take royalty at all, and that is to get benefits beyond those that are available to us through in money taking. Given the basic statute and the amendment which changed the presumption to an in-kind taking, we set out more than a year ago to make a determination as to what was in the best interest of the state for the large amount of Prudhoe Bay royalty crude. Now, the first question, of course, that we had to ask was this: was the expectation in the royalty statute realistic in light of the real world as it is today and as it will likely be in the foreseeable future? In other words, could such a project defined generally by the royalty statute, succeed in the marketplace today? Now, there's been a lot of talk about that, both early on in negotiations and since completion of negotiations. Certainly a large body of academics who did conventional wisdom macro analyses of the situation, I won't name them all, you've heard most of the reports, they said, no, this is not possible, theoretically. Certainly a large body of entrepreneurs, the people who put these things together in the past, said, yes, we think we can make it work, and we're willing to bet several $1 million that we can. From all of this talk, it became clear to us, in any event, that no one can know right now whether this project can succeed in the marketplace. We publicly stated that we won't be able to know that, but we determined to construct the contract to allow the traditional marketplace to decide whether or not this could happen, and to structure into the contract a shield from the risk of failure for the state. We set out by setting the boundaries in which we would keep our negotiation. That is, there would be no price subsidy offered with our crude oil. There would be supplemental environmental stipulations involved. There would be stipulations involving job training and local hire, and there would be a requirement that at least some in-state fuel products, enough to meet our projected in-state demand, be created by any refinery. We set out to set these boundaries and then to clearly establish that the entrepreneurial risk rested where it belongs, with the private sector and not with the state. Since that time, all consultants agree to a greater or lesser extent that the contract before you now is a reasonable and fair contract given the presumptions. Given the presumption that we want to leverage our royalty share into jobs, in-state products, associated development, and the additional revenue that comes from this development. Given that the state wants to lever it into these things which require a successful and substantial private venture. And given the second presumption that we want the risks of the venture to be strictly and clearly resting on the private sector. All the consultants say, again, to a greater or lesser extent, that the contract is reasonable and fair given these presumptions. Now, there have arisen clearly several questions regarding individual sections of the contract, and I will mention briefly a few of these and hopefully clear up some misunderstandings. Most of the fears that I've heard expressed to me by legislators and others revolve around the delivery of crude oil to Alpetco before actual startup of the refinery. And these fears can be broken down into several subcategories. And certainly, Fred and I thought these through at great length over the preceding months. And we clearly concluded that the risks are not great enough to cause serious concern, given the contract as a whole. Not given one little section, but given the whole machine of the contract. The first fear seems to be sort of a not clearly defined fear that somehow Alpetco is going to get control over our crude oil and we'll never be able to get it back. Now clearly the crude oil under the contract will be delivered day after day after day. They don't suddenly get title to our in-place reserves under this contract. At any given time after we start delivering crude, only a small amount of that oil is in their possession for which they have not paid. And the security clauses of this contract clearly are strongly in the state's interest. For example, if Alpetco has 30 days of crude that they haven't paid for, we're holding security liens that cover this more than twice. So there's no fear there. Secondly, when they do have control of our crude, they're paying the full price that we would get otherwise. So the fear of our losing money every day when we deliver is simply not a valid fear. Thirdly, to retain control of this crude once delivery begins, Alpetco very clearly again has to meet every other term of the contract. Upon their default or their fail to meet a benchmark, a performance term, we simply shut off the valve. And any attorney will tell you that the presumption is clearly on our side. It's our commodity, and we can refuse to deliver to them if they have not delivered on the other terms of the contract. So basically, the first day we deliver crude to Alpetco does not lock us into delivering it to them forevermore if they don't perform under the contract. Any more than the first day we delivered our royalty crude to Sohio, Exxon, and ARCO locked us into never taking it back in an in-kind taking. We clearly have control over our crude throughout the contract, unless Alpetco meets all the terms, which is what we want them to do. The second fear of early delivery seems to revolve around a presumption that Alpetco will somehow contrive to market our crude at a great profit, a profit that we could otherwise make. Now, an examination of the facts, the pricing term of the contract, the facts as they exist in the marketplace and will exist in the foreseeable future will show that this just cannot happen. First of all, as Mr. Johnson pointed out, the price Alpetco will pay will be set by the marketplace. In fact, in the interim, in the next several months, it'll be higher than the marketplace. Now, anyone who could contrive to lift crude at a price higher than the market and make a profit on it is operating in a way that I wish I understood. The second part of this assumption is that the state could make this profit that Alpetco is making if Alpetco wasn't making it, perhaps by getting in the spot market or whatever. Now, the report that Patel did for the House, I think, clearly dispels that notion. And I won't go into it in detail, except to point out that, first of all, seeing the state compete in the marketplace with Exxon, ARCO, and Sohio, I think, is a pretty unlikely assumption. Secondly, I don't think that the Department of Natural Resources should have a room full of petroleum marketers with telephones trying to flog the stuff daily on a daily basis. And thirdly, entering into any short-term sales after you've told the producers that you're going to lift the crude incurs a great risk of loss as well as a possible potential of gain. Once we give notice, as you're aware, under the unit agreement that we want to take the crude in kind, we've got to keep doing it for 6 months. And if we have to sell it on a daily basis, we could well take a bath, receiving far less than we would if we continued to take in value. But again, I'll refer you to the Battelle report, which points out that very unlikely the state could take in kind and make a profit over what we would receive in value or from this contract. A third fear that hinges on early delivery of crude is the fear that Alpetco never intends to build this refinery and that somehow they just won't do it. Well, we could refer you to 6 or 8 clauses in this contract that require they build a refinery. That's part of the performance clauses of the contract. It says right early on in the contract that they shall construct and start up facilities for fuels, olefins, aromatics, that describes the contract. It says that they have to expand the contract.
And the tax revenues from a sizable investment in property. The fifth concern, which I will address, is the question, is Alaska committing all of its future royalty oil to Alpetco? The answer to this is no. Article 2.4 of the contract provides that Alpetco's option on non-Prudhoe Bay oil is limited. In the first place, it's limited to the amount needed from other locations, if any, to bring the total amount of royalty oil we purchase up to a maximum of 150,000 barrels per day, which was the quantity the state originally indicated its intention to sell, and it is the quantity necessary to provide the assured feedstock supply to the facilities we plan to build. So we must have the feedstock if we're to build the facility. Secondly, such makeup quantity must come from not more than 70% of non-Prudhoe Bay royalty oil, not otherwise committed under existing contracts or renewals of these contracts to North Pole Refining and to Tesoro. So we cannot take ask for any of their oil, nor can we ask for more than 70% of any other oil, and we can only ask for this option oil, A, if we're not getting enough from Prudhoe Bay, and B, after we started operating the facility. This option does not come into play until after we started up the plant. Regarding this so-called 70% option, Milton Lipton told the two special committees of the Senate and House at their joint meetings on March the 15th, quote, "I think if you want this kind of a project, whether it's this group or another group, you're going to have to give assurance of supply." He went on to say, "Nothing's going to fly unless you're prepared to commit the 100 or 125 out of the 150, which means also the right of first refusal over any deficiency out of the Prudhoe Bay royalty oil or other royalty oil anywhere else in the state. That is, whether it's this particular project or whether you say no to this and Dow Chemical comes back 3 years from now, if you're going to offset competitive disadvantages by assured availability, you've got to assure the availability," end of quote. The real question involved with the 70% option is whether or not the legislature wants a petrochemical plant in Alaska. If you want the value added here, fine. If not, it will be added some other place besides Alaska. Do you want the 2,000 to 3,000 new permanent jobs
or not? Do you want the $49 million a year we estimate in additional state and local taxes or not? These are questions only you can answer. But they do relate, we feel, and hinge upon keeping in the contract the 70% option provision. Following testimony to the special committee of the House and following its negative report to the full House, Alpetco, in an effort to clarify any misunderstandings, sent a letter to Governor Hammond in response. This letter was in response to concerns which had been expressed, and it was an attempt to clarify our intent with respect to 3 points which have been mentioned earlier by Commissioner LaResch. First, to clarify the meaning of commit to expend. Secondly, to say that we would not take any oil for 25 months after the effective date of the agreement. And thirdly, to clarify the terms so that there was no misunderstanding about the fact that any money we paid for oil would not be counted on the benchmark monetary requirements. Another concern I referred to earlier that has been expressed is that Alpetco is a paper corporation. Because of this question, but more importantly because of the huge financing which will be involved in the Alpetco project, we asked Jim Lott if he would be here to briefly discuss the permanent financing and to answer any questions you have in the financial area. Jim?
Thank you, Charles. Senators, I do represent E.F. Putnam Company. I also represent our co-investment banker, Lehman Brothers Kuhn Loeb, out of New York. We have been involved with Alpetco as financial advisors of this project since its very inception some year ago. We've had several meetings, countless meetings with their banker, Chemical Bank, and with the company in structuring a financing structure which we think would be marketable. It's been our recommendation that the refinery complex should be financed under what we would call a project financing. And if it's done that way, we're prepared to undertake the project and believe that the funds can be raised. Now, to you gentlemen, senators, that are not involved in projects every day, let me try and say in English just what a project financing is. It's really analogous to you might look at it as a three-legged stool. If you have all three pegs, the stool stand up. If you don't, it's going to fall down on you. In essence, the lenders, rather than looking at the corporate credit or corporate guarantee, really look at the structure itself and says, are the structure, is the supply contract and the contract management going to support the project? First of all, they'll look at, well, let's call it the supply agreement. They look at the adequacy of it, they look at the acceptability of it, and the dependability of it. Because this crude supply agreement is going to be the first ingredient, the only ingredient, the important ingredient to make the process work. Secondly, they're going to look at management's ability to organize and coordinate that raw material product. And thirdly, they're going to look at the long-term purchase contract. You've got to have a minimum of fixed price, long-term contract to repay the debt. Now, if you've got those three ingredients, supply, assured supply, management, and contract for the output of the refinery with margin sufficient in the investor's mind to be able to repay the debt, then you have what we call a project financing. And it's a very reasonable one. With so many demands for capital today, more and more corporations have to limit their corporate guarantees to those projects which don't lend themselves so much to a project financing. This is a typical type of financing which in today's environment is being utilized more and more by companies to finance natural resource projects. In the United States, some recent project financings might be helpful. Atlantic Richfield in Channelview, Texas recently did a project financing on a petrochemical complex down there. Union Carbide recently did a coal project in Utah project financing. In Canada, a United States Steel did a project financing for Quebec Hydroelectric. In British Columbia, they had Fording Coal and Lornex Copper. These were financed by the takers of the project, where the institutional lenders looked to the resources, the management, and the contracts to finance those. In Australia, in the area of iron ore, you've had Savage River, Rogue River, and Hammerslide projects. All these were financed under contract. I think most pertinently, you can look at Alaska Interstate's involvement recently in the Indonesian project, where they were responsible for restructuring the success of the $1.5 billion LNG project, where based on a project financing, Japanese utilities supplied, or based on Japanese contracts, $1.5 billion was completely 100% debt financed. Now, when we've looked at raising capital, you're going to really have to break capital down into two categories, equity and debt. Now, on the equity side, E.F. Putnam and Kuhnwald, on December 12, 1977, wrote a letter in which we stated that, and this letter was addressed to Alpetco, that if the conditions exist that I just mentioned under project financing, that we were prepared and believed it was feasible to raise the required equity funds to support the financial structure of the refinery complex. We would look for the equity to come from the equity partners that they'll bring into the project. Alpetco has stated in the past that other people will be participants with them. We believe the economics of the project will support equity participation. On top of that, as you know, under the benchmark test, Alpetco will be required to put up $10 million over the first, I believe it's 18-month period. Together with our raising of equity funds, I believe anyone knowledgeable in the financial community would not refer to this as a paper corporation. Any of these project financing corporations grow on themselves structurally and financially as the project proceeds. This is typical. From the debt side, we see the funds coming first from the commercial banks, both domestic and foreign. And the representative Chemical Bank is here today. You've heard him testify before, some of you before, on just what their commitment to the project was. We're looking for the long-term source of the funds to come from principally life insurance and casualty insurance markets, the pension, profit, and retirement system. We also believe that a portion of the funds could be financed under your Chapter 61, Title 44, Alaska Industrial Development Authority. Maybe as much as $500 million of that would qualify for tax-exempt financing, which, of course, lowers the cost of the project by 2% over the cost of corporate funds. So, in summary, that's how we see it operating, and I'd be happy to answer any more specific questions you might wish to address to me. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Jim. I'd like to ask next if Gordon Kane will speak to the question of how he feels petrochemicals make sense in Alaska, and perhaps tell you something about how he sees this project proceeding forward. Gordon?
Senator Galletta, gentleman of the committee. The question has been raised as to whether or not it is possible to build a viable petrochemical operation in Alaska or not. And it's been pointed out that the construction costs in Alaska are higher than here than many other parts of the world, that operating costs here are higher, that the products, the petrochemicals that we plan to make are in long supply all over the world. And if we thought that these conditions would go on forever, I would have to agree with the people who raised the question about the viability of this project. But nothing goes on forever without change, and certainly we think that's true here. The conventional wisdom in the energy business is that there will be a shortage of crude oil sometime in the middle 1980s and possibly before that. And at whatever point, not necessarily that there is a shortage, but that people perceive that there will be a shortage, then at that point, having an assured supply of 150,000 barrels of crude oil a day in a politically stable region such as Alaska will be a very valuable thing to have. And it's that point, which we think will come within the next three or four years. We are confident that the availability of this crude will make it possible for us to find customers for these petrochemicals who will make commitments that will permit us to do the kind of financing that Mr. Lopp has described. And so on this basis, we are proceeding, and I'd like to tell you at least a little about how we plan to proceed. In the original submission, Alpetco outlined the kind of petrochemical units that would be built. It was pointed out at that time that it might be necessary to modify the time of startup for the various units. I'd like to outline to you the manner in which we think now Alpetco would proceed. I must add the change market conditions 18 months from now when we would make a final decision might change these plans. If we were making the plans today, the first unit we would be build would be 150,000 barrel a day crude unit. This would separate the crude into such products as straight run gasoline, kerosene, gas oil, and heavy fuel oil. We are confident that we can sell all these products now, except the heavy fuel, on short-term contracts to independent refineries on the West Coast and in Hawaii. We could start the first Alpetco unit, or we can start the first Alpetco unit whenever we can find an outlet for this heavy fuel oil, and certainly doing that will be the main focus of our early effort. While the crude unit is under construction, we would start construction of a series of units that would come on stream at about 1 year intervals. These would be a unit to desulfurize the kerosene to make it into marketable jet fuel, units to desulfurize and hydrocrack the gas oil to make low sulfur fuel for the West Coast utility market and diesel fuel for Alaska, a reformer to convert the straight run gasoline into high octane gasoline, an aromatics extraction unit to remove aromatics from the part of the high octane gasoline that would not be needed in Alaska, an olefins unit to crack the naphtha from the aromatics extraction. We would hope that at this time, some of the gas liquids from the gas pipeline would be available as feedstock for this olefin plant. Now, there are several reasons for extending the construction and startup of the Alpetco units over several years. Doing this, we can have a small construction force over 6 years rather than a large construction force over 1 or 2 years. This will improve construction efficiency and lessen the local impact whenever the construction is finished. We distribute the job of training the people and starting up the units over several years. And importantly, it will delay the production of olefins, which are currently in surplus, until a time we think the market will be more favorable. Now let's look at some of these objections that have been raised in the light of these plans. There's an objection to Alpetco taking crude before the plant starts. First, we have no interest in becoming brokers of crude oil. I think that Mr. Johnson, in his testimony before to you at a previous meeting, said that he didn't think he could sell the Alaskan crude to any greater advantage than you are selling it now. And certainly if he, with all of his experience in this, can't do it, certainly we don't have any illusions that we can do it. We want to take crude for some period before we start so that we can trade this crude for products and make processing agreements with other people so that we will have product to develop markets in advance of the start of our plant. It will also give us product so that we can ensure delivery to our customers in the event that there's some delay in the start of our plant. Now, if early delivery of crude will help the Alpetco project, there's no valid reason for an objection unless, in so doing, we penalize the state of Alaska. So let's examine the question of whether or not our taking crude early would penalize the state of Alaska. Battelle has reported that while they could see a theoretical possibility that our sales of crude on the West Coast could reduce the average net on Alaska crude, they did not regard this as a practical possibility. Mr. Johnson, in his testimony before you a few minutes ago, has confirmed that the property of crude on the West Coast below the present price was developed by Dr. Petrie, and unfortunately he based his conclusion on the same incorrect interpretation of the pricing provision of the contract that Mr. Baird.
It's in effect. Our Supreme Court affirmed it, so that it was therefore in effect.
Frankly, we wish that Dr. Petrie and Mr. Johnson, the original interpretation of the price.
One could probably, I'm speculating here, get into some lawyers' arguments about whether what could happen given the fact that it's pending before the United States Supreme Court, although I believe my simple answer is yes, it's enforceable. They did act,
but the first
we are enforcing.
We will deal with the head of the passage of the process, 150,000 barrels a day of crude. Further, we have a commitment to extend $1.5 billion in Alaska. Now, the principal reason that we will build 150,000 barrels a day crude units,
not to my knowledge,
is that when we invest $1.5 billion, we must earn charges on this capital. And the depreciation, interest, and return on investment will require an
That has been done. There's a letter executed by Commissioner LaResh and by them, which simply notes that the word unconditional will involve
a year if we take the 450,000 barrels.
I'm sorry, I thought that was
$375 million if you divide by 50 million barrels of fuel is something around $7 a barrel. But we must land on every one of the 150,000 barrels a day simply to cover capital costs. It's not realistic to suggest that we would willingly divert some of the crude on which we must make a minimum of $7 a day to cover capital charges into direct sales for the
I will come back to order. Mr. Holly from El Petco, sir, your party
Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman, Senators, we appreciate this opportunity to discuss with you what we consider to be a very important matter. I'm chairman of Alpetco, and with me today are a number of people who are experts in their particular fields and who will be made available later to answer any questions you may have in their particular areas. We would like to keep our remarks as brief as possible so that you will have maximum time to ask questions and clarify issues. We've made available to you a copy of the presentation we made to the joint meeting of the Special Committees of the Senate and House on March 13th. Before we begin, I would like to introduce our representatives here so that you will know who they are and where you may wish to direct questions to any of them. On my left is Gordon Kane, who is President and Chief Executive Officer of Alpetco. Mr. Kane has over 30 years of experience in the petrochemical industry, most of it as a chief executive. He's formed new petrochemical joint ventures both in the U.S. and abroad, and he is considered to be an outstanding petrochemical authority. On my right is Jim Lopp, who is Executive Vice President of E.F. Hutton and Company. Mr. Lopp is co-investment banker for Alpetco, along with Lehman Brothers Kuhn Loeb. His responsibilities are for arranging long-term financing. He is experienced in Alaska financing and is the individual primarily responsible for putting together the technical aspects of the Valdez terminal financing when he was with another investment banking firm. With us also today is Willard Hanslick, who is a vice president of Alpetco and a director. He is responsible for planning and administration. He is also a vice president of Alaska Interstate Company. John Gunderson, I believe, not here yet. John is a director of Alpetco, and he's been involved in planning for Alaska Consolidated Shipping's training courses, both in maritime and refinery operation. Eddie Rogers is a special counsel and a director of Alpetco, and Eddie is primarily responsible for drafting the agreement from the standpoint of Alpetco, and worked with Fred Vaness over a period of time doing this. Pat Dyer is with us. He is a special counsel to Alpetco, and he assisted in drafting the agreement, and he is also general counsel for Alaska Interstate Company. Joe Tidings is a special counsel to Alpetco. Mr. Tiding is counsel for us in Washington, D.C., and represents several Japanese industrial groups and governmental groups in Washington. He has accompanied Alpetco on 3 of our 4 visits to Japan. Kathy Chandler is a special counsel to Alpetco, and she represents us in the state of Alaska. John Mizzuto is with us also. He is a vice president of Chemical Bank, and Chemical Bank is responsible for arranging our construction financing and our working capital requirements. Mr. Mizzuto is experienced in making similar loans for major energy projects. Harry Eaton is with us. He is vice chairman of Alaska Consolidated Shipping and treasurer of Koniag. Ronald Dakin is with us. He is Alaska representative of C-Train Lines, Inc., and has worked on our training program. A word or two about where we think we are today. It was over a year ago in May that the State Royalty Board established 8 policies or guidelines for taking oil in kind. Based on those guidelines, as Commissioner LaResh said, they then proceeded to obtain interested parties. After many months of competition and negotiations, Alpetco was selected by the Royalty Board and executed the contract before you. This contract, which is now before the Senate for approval, is unique. We know of no other state that has ever outlined so precisely its requirements for development of its natural resources, and no instance where a company has agreed to undertake such a project without incentives or subsidies from the government. The criteria established by the administration were extremely tight, and the procedures followed have been thorough. Formal proposals were submitted and presented last August and October. In September, the commissioner circulated proposed contract objectives and a request for legislative and public comments and suggestions. We met publicly with the Royalty Board in Anchorage, Valdez, and Juneau, and with the State Energy Policy Committee at a public meeting in Anchorage. We have put on programs to educate the public, inform the public in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kenai, and Seward, and also to answer questions. Rigorous procedures were followed in negotiating this contract for the state. The contract was drafted with the consultation of the Department of Law of the state and a prominent New York law firm. Also, consultants on the contract were, as has been mentioned, were Smith Barney, Bonner and Moore, and Arnold Tessing. Alpetco's lawyers reviewed the contract with counsel for our lenders and with lawyers familiar with the Department of Energy matters. Further, Alpetco obtained a favorable opinion from the Department of Energy, which serves to protect the state of Alaska's future rights with respect to our taking the crude. I am told that there were some 25 or 30 drafts of the contract leading up to the final executed agreement. It would be difficult for us to imagine how the contract could have been more carefully or more thoroughly drawn. One of your consultants, Milton Lipton, who had both pluses and minuses to say about the Alpetco project, was consistently complimentary about the contract itself. In testimony before the joint meeting of the Senate and House Special Oil and Gas Committees on March 15th, Mr. Lipton said, quote, I think in many respects the contract is as carefully worded as it can be to minimize the state's risk. He went on to say, I think that you've got negotiated both by the state and by the Alpetco group as imaginative a combination of factors into a contract as you could get, particularly in view of the fact that nobody else was forthcoming. Yes, it's a heroic effort on both parties' part, and I think a very carefully drawn contract. Following execution of the contract in February, Alpetco made an initial presentation to a joint meeting of the Senate and House Special Committees on March 13th, which was followed by additional committee meetings to hear committee consultants. On April the 27th, the House Special Committee issued its report, which was unfavorable, and reported out of committee by a vote of 4-1. On May the 2nd, the House voted approval of the Alpetco resolution by a vote of 21-17, then agreed to reconsider, which it did on May 10, when it voted 20-19 to amend the resolution and then conditionally approved the resolution subject to the amendment by a vote of 32-7. While we have no quarrel or problem with the substance of the amendment, we cannot live with it as written, as Commissioner Laresh has commented. Mr. Kane will also discuss this aspect later. We think there are probably six key concerns which have been expressed by legislators, primarily during the House debate, but also to some extent in the Senate. And we'd like to comment on these six. They're not all the concerns, but we think they're the principal ones. The first one is, why does Alpetco want to purchase royalty crude before the facility starts up? Mr. Kane will comment on that during his remarks. Will all the royalty crude be processed in Alaska? Mr. Kane will also address that question. Will the Alpetco project cost Alaska billions of dollars, as alleged by the Institute of Social and Economic Research in its April 1978 report? Will Alpetco complete the facility, then later get into trouble and ask for a subsidy? Is Alaska committing all of its future royalty oil to Alpetco? And lastly, is Alpetco just a paper corporation, assuming no risks and contributing none of its money to this project? That last question will be addressed by Mr. Lopp when he discusses the financial aspect of our proposal. Going back to the third expressed concern, will the Alpetco project cost Alaska billions of dollars, as alleged by the Institute of Social and Economic Research in its April 1978 report? So far as we know, the validity of that ISER report has not been publicly challenged, to our knowledge. Yet at least three parties, in addition to Alpetco, have written specific and strong rebuttals to that report. The ISER report concluded that the project would have a significant negative impact on the state's fiscal position. In other words, that it would induce increases in state government expenditures, which are larger in size than the increases generated by Alpetco in state revenues. First of all, our economists examined the report and discovered three mathematical or procedural errors. The report erred in its calculation of income taxes, second, its treatment of income to the permanent fund, and thirdly, it completely ignored our contractual commitment to contribute 5% of Alpetco's after-tax profits after 10 years to a state-administered fund beginning in the 11th year after plant startup. Reflection of these three errors alone resulted in a $1 billion change, not million, but billion-dollar change, from negative to positive. Secondly, an Alaska economist, Robert Richards, in Anchorage, examined the report and wrote a letter to the director of the Institute, which challenged the reasonableness of the Institute's key assumption. that is the employment multiplier factor. Mr. Richards' letter states in part, quote, clearly your unreasonably high assumption regarding the multiplier and the population employment ratio have led you to a substantial error in forecasting the population and employment impact of the Alpetco project, about 3.5 times too high. Mr. Richards' letter concluded, there the researcher's conclusion is absurd. Finally, Mr. Richards requested Professor Ezra Solomon of Stanford University, dean of the finance school there, to review the ISER study. Professor Solomon's response, which is, I believe you have furnished you, states in part, quote, the alleged conclusion is not a conclusion at all in the normal sense of the word. It is simply the basic assumption which was fed into the model, the computer model, in the first place. Put in the simplest terms, this assumption is that any increase in personal income will bring about a larger increase in state expenditures than it generates in state revenues. Given this assumption, it must follow that any new activity, still quoting Dr. Solomon, any new activity except new petroleum extraction, which increases the level of Alaska employment and income, must also increase state government expenditures by more than it increases the state's revenues. That is, it will have a negative fiscal impact. The bigger the rise in income, the worse this impact will be. Continuing his quote, in my opinion, the assumption itself is not a valid basis for policy decision about Alaska's future development. I suppose the real question is, do you believe that creating new permanent jobs in Alaska is basically bad, or do you favor adding a reasonable number of new jobs? The next key concern I would like to comment on is the fourth one. Will Alpetco complete the facility, then later get in trouble and ask for a subsidy? Some critics have asserted that Alpetco may complete the facility and later fall on hard times for one reason or another, and then return to the state for a subsidy in the form probably of a lower price for the royalty oil. Stripped of its Alpetco trappings, this concern is really just another way to argue for no growth, because all new ventures, whatever size and whatever industry, have an operating risk. In this case, Alpetco's project has about as much protection to the state, we believe, as is possible. The lenders will insist that the project is solid before they lend us any money. If appropriate security doesn't exist, in the lender's opinion, they will not lend the funds to build the facility in the first place. If in the future, due to some unforeseen circumstances, the project should have difficulties, historically it is the lenders and the owners who first attempt to work out the problems. This could be true in the debt the same.
It is a complex and difficult problem we are working on.
Well, Senator, first, as we have said, just the sheer economics force us to build as big a unit and process as much crude as we can. And since the most the state will sell us is 150,000 barrels, it's been our intention all along to build 150,000 barrel units. Now, the capacity of a unit like that is just very simply how much you can put through it in one day, in one week, in one month. And at some point after the thing is lined out, its capacity is whatever we can demonstrate that we can process in whatever time would have any objection to demonstrating this capacity if that were a requirement. And it's, and I think we said all along, we really haven't any objection with the principles that have been raised in some of these objections here, because most of them are simple, are taken care of simply by what we intend to do anyway. We intend to build 150,000 barrels a day. We don't have any illusions that we can go into the crude oil brokering business. So as long as you will let us do the things that will help us make this a success, mainly get oil for trading, for getting products initially, we have no quarrel with the intent of the objective. Well, certainly the combination of those and the things that we have said here reflect our position.
We have previously submitted a letter to Alpetco, to West Interstate, indicating that upon the approval of various bodies necessary for the contract to go into effect, that we will set up a credit facility where they could draw up to $20 million within this groundwork period to fund the groundwork expenses. We intend to create a normal credit agreement that we create for any other company to fit the circumstances, and it'll be designed to fund their equity contributions to do the groundwork expenses. So I can't think of anything that would be peculiar or incidental other than a normal type of credit. Maybe I'll defer to the company. I think if they feel that it's unworkable, they're not going to ask us to lend them the money.
Senator, certainly the biggest near-term problem we would have is finding a place to get rid of the heavy fuel from this facility. And the most likely solution is to be able to export it. And certainly all of our effort over the next few months after ratification will be directed toward getting permission from the Department of Commerce to export it. I already have a place to sell it if I can get a permit. I've already have the customer, but we don't have the permit. So our main focus over the next few months is going to solve that problem. We're going to be just trying to get an export permit. If we're unable to get an export permit, we have a rather serious problem, and I'm not sure that we have a quick solution to it. The processes for converting this heavy fuel into other products are expensive and generally not terribly economic. And I think we'd hate very much to burden this Alpetro project with such high-cost operations as would be involved in processing this oil. So we want the state of Alaska to help us exert all of the influence we can to get this export permit. That certainly is, it is certainly a very important factor.
Right, well,
no. Whoever gets the export permit will get it.
I think first it would hinge on the operational viability, and if it's not operational at a lower level, then there would be a financing problem. If it is viable operationally, then there would not be a financing problem if the numbers fit. I think on the operational, I would defer to Gordon Payne on that.
There are no operational problems if we can't run at less than 150,000 barrels, but as you know, if we can find the market, the economics of this will improve with size. Our costs will not go up as fast as the revenue will go up. So it's certainly in our interest to operate this at as high a rate as we can. Now, I'm not prepared to say that 145 would be acceptable, 142 would not. But certainly, this is a project that needs all the help it can get. And so cutting it back to some other number is just going to make it a hell of a lot even tougher than it is now. Well, certainly the economics of 100,000 would be poorer than the economics of 150,000. Probably one of the most difficult decisions that we will have to make at the critical point 18 months from now is whether or not we think there's going to be 150,000 barrels of oil here a day for a long enough period to pay this off. Now, this is probably almost the go, no-go kind of thing. Now, my guess is that if there's no more discovery of oil in Alaska between now and then, if it is clear that the Prudhoe Bay is going to go down at the rate that some of these people have projected, if Lower Cook Inlet turns out to be a dud and there's no other exploration in being,
it may not be possible to have enough crude to support such a unit. But that isn't a decision we have to make now.
You are aware that there will not be enough space?
No, I'm only aware that if you take the current Prudhoe Bay production and project it, and if you assume that there's no, what you say is true, if you assume there's no extension of Prudhoe Bay. But I don't think we're ready to assume that yet.
As you are well aware right now, most oil is delivered, not just
something like that. That's, yes. No, I don't know that. No. I think we're making a bet it will be good. No, I don't know. I think it could come from the extension of the North Slope. You know, Exxon had just announced another fine east of the North Slope. We think it's unlikely that all of the North Slope is completely developed and that the last field in that area has been found. It's close to it. Well, there are very few pipelines through which you can't get some more crude if you've got it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Senator Huber is waiting.
I'd just like to do one part of the question.
Yes. No, I think that, I find it hard to put a number on it, but certainly enough additional production to maintain the Prudhoe Bay capacity at approximately the same level for 20 years or some number like that. Could be. That I think would be a good guess, yes. You'd have to find half again as much oil over the next 10 years.
I wonder if it may be a priority.
Senator.
Yes, Senator Cross.
That assumes the government's present and operating plan. And there are people who take the seat that said that fields and the business potential amount of additional oil if a new operating plan is provided. It's not that it's not that it's a good business. You can recover up to 50% more.
And then we're dealing with supplemental bonds to add to that potential.
How do these
No, I understand, but I mean, in order to maintain the maximum flow rate or in order to maintain flow rate that maximum, that would then, we could mean we'd have to find supplemental oil to add to the oil coming out of Crudo Bay.
Ms. Chatterton, we appreciate your concern about whether we'll have enough oil or not, and certainly examining this question is going to be one of the activities that whoever lends us money will be engaged in. But there are several possible solutions to this. First, there's a possible solution that might come out of further oil discoveries here. Second, there will still be a lot of oil coming down the pipeline from Prudhoe Bay, even if 1/8 of it is not equal to our 150,000 barrels. And at that point, we don't think it's out of the question that we could buy the difference between what you're giving us and what we need from some of the existing producers. So the appraisal of all of these factors are going to have to be part of our appraisal of the total project when we make the final decision to go ahead. We would not spend the substantial amount of money we plan to spend between now and 18 months from now unless we thought the probability was good that the decision there would be favorable.
Allow me just a thought, thinking out loud, but that discussion, although parts that are very relevant to the El Petro supply, you bring up an interesting point, at least thinking out loud in my mind. You mean that pipeline is about 40% over capacity built? Wasn't that thing supposed to carry 2 million barrels a day?
1.5, I think, was the senator. I believe that the pipeline was virtually at capacity now for the pump stations are now showing how the additional pump stations and the very high capital cost can be added.
Sure, that's true.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, my yes. observation, though, is beyond the optics of things, so just allow it for a minute. I can't imagine, for the life of me, that somebody would have invested in a pipeline to pump 1.2 million barrels a day and then say, okay, the peak that we're going to need this sort of capacity out of that line is 6-7 years. And that, you know, they and their wisdom felt that there was not a sufficient supply of oil to pump into it or funnel into it to maintain something close to that flow rate. It just doesn't make sense to me. And that, to that I was addressing in my more immediate concern is that if it does roll off and there is no more oil, the concern is not for Alpeco, it's for the state budget. Are we close? I didn't
want to
leave.
We're getting very close. Any other questions? None. Mr. Johnson, do you have any questions?
No, I don't.
Does any of the participants have any questions to Mr. Johnson? We'll allow that also.
There'll be a hanging right after the...
Mr. Chairman, if
yes.
I may add just one postscript to what's been said about the Prudhoe Bay Reservoir. We at last interstate have used for many years a rather well-known reservoir engineering firm by the name of, it was Butler Miller and Ness, and now it's Miller and Ness. And they're regarded as one of the best around. And when we first became interested in the Alpetco project, one of the first things we did was to have Miller and Lentz, who does other reservoir work for us, look at this situation. And while they have, they share the concern that you mentioned, Jadison, they concluded that it is premature, as far as their concern, to, based on their knowledge, it's premature to determine the exact configuration of the Prudhoe Bay Reservoir, because there's not been enough production of oil long enough to be sure about it. You can make some estimates, but their conclusion at least was that it was premature and could not be really done until there's been more years of production. It involves a complicated situation, including the gas cap and non-gas cap gas and the shape of the reservoir and what would be the most efficient way to produce it. All these being problems that the producers are constantly addressing. But at least Miller Lentz felt that it was premature today to firm up any production conclusion until there's been more history.
Well, I wish to thank all of you for taking the time to come. Committees certainly appreciate the information and the candidness in answering the questions that we've asked. Thank you. We're adjourned.
I didn't want to necessarily follow up.